the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, a 1945 graduate of West Point, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, and the co-author with Joe Galloway of the acclaimed book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. That was later made into a feature movie, starring Mel Gibson as then Lieutenant Colonel Moore. General Moore's chronicle begins in a small town in Kentucky.
I was born on the 13th of February, 1922, in a small town in Kentucky, Bardstown, B-A-R-D-S-T-O-W-N, 1,200 people. I was born into a family of four children. I was the eldest, and my father was an insurance agent. He was a Catholic. My mother was Methodist. But we were raised Catholic, and I went to a Catholic grade school taught by the nuns of Sisters of Charity. Then I went to a prep school in town taught by the Brothers of St. Francis Xavier. So my early life was influenced very heavily by spiritual activities and spiritual study, and I've continued that throughout my life. Life is so temporary on this earth. Everything is temporal. Human life, animal life, vegetable life. This is a temporary time. And life on earth is just a tryout to see if you make the cut for eternal life. That's been my objective all of my life, and as I have grown older, I realize that I don't have much time left in the game, and I'm trying to do everything I can to make the cut.
How do you, if you do, or if it's necessary, reconcile that kind of deep religious faith with a military career?
Well, I think they're conjoined. You can be a spiritual person and still be a killer on the battlefield, believing that you're doing the right thing. When I was 17 years old, my father suggested to me that I attempt to get into West Point and become an Army officer. And that became my goal, and I started writing letters to congressmen and senators, but without any positive results. And one day in February, when I was 17 years old, February of 1940, my father came home, and I was sick in bed with pneumonia, and he said that the local representative of Senator Happy Chandler has an opening in the Senate book warehouse for a young boy, and the job is yours if you want it. It pays $30 a week. And I was in my last year of prep school, St. Joseph Prep School, and he said, you'd have a heck of a lot better chance of getting into West Point if you were in Washington, D.C., where the appointments are handed out, and writing letters in a small town in Kentucky. So he was right, and I took the job. I left the next morning and finished high school at night with middle-aged cab drivers and government workers, and lived in a boarding house with an elderly couple, and Then I went to George Washington University for a little over 2 years at night, and joined a fraternity. And all the while, I would get, every 2 weeks, I get the list of appointments that were unfilled for West Point. And I'd go knock on the doors without any positive results. Until May of 1942, the Congress authorized every senator and congressman to have an additional appointment to West Point and to Annapolis. There was no Air Force Academy. The war was on, so they wanted to get more officers in the field. So I went to my congressman and I asked him for his additional appointment to West Point. And he said he regretted, but he'd already promised it to another young man, and I couldn't have it. So I said, well, will you give me your appointment to Annapolis? And he said, yes. So I said, do I have that now? He said, yes. So I'm 20 years old. So I said, sir, if I can find another congressman that will swap a West Point appointment for Annapolis appointment, would you go along with it? And he smiled and he said, yes. It took me 10 days. And I found a congressman from Georgia who would appoint me to West Point if my congressman would appoint his kid to Annapolis. So I was appointed to West Point out of Georgia. I never had been in the state of Georgia. That's how I got into West Point.
That's a great story.
Well, you know what? I learned a very valuable lesson. There's always one more thing you can do in any situation to influence that situation in your favor. And after that, one more thing. And the more one more things you do, the more opportunities are created. And I really, to this day, I don't know why I guess I had to know that I had something in the back of my mind. If I didn't want to go to Annapolis, but I wanted to go to West Point. So I went to West Point, and I was, you might say, dumb in mathematics, which is the basis of all courses at West Point. You graduate from West Point in those days with a degree, you were a civil engineer. And all of those mathematics courses, calculus, differential equations, vector analysis, mechanics, industrial engineering, inside of two months, I was on the deficient list of cadets who were deficient in mathematics. If I didn't get my grades up passing level by Christmas, I'd been gone. So I started studying every night after taps, after lights out at 11 o'clock. And there were four cadet rooms on this hall I was in. At the end of the hall was a toilet with two commodes. And I sat on a commode under a 40-watt light bulb for the next 3 years studying after taps until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
And I
graduated at the top of the bottom 20% of my class.
The top of the bottom 20%?
Yeah.
Well, in both getting the appointment and managing to keep it, there's another quality, it seems to me, of having read about you and one certainly very famous book that served you well throughout your military career. And I would say the word is perseverance. And yeah. I'm reminded also of the fact that one of your earlier classmates at West Point had the same problem you did, nearly flunked out, went on to become what I think is one of the greatest generals in the history of this country, and that's Stonewall Jackson.
Oh, yeah, right.
He came very close to flunking out when he was a cadet, too. So
there stands Jackson, like a stone wall.
Great general. When you graduated, where did you go next?
I graduated. I selected to be an infantry officer, and I went to the war was still going on, and I was headed for the war in Japan. And the war ended in August, and I was sent to the Philippines, and from there up to the occupation of Japan, where I became a paratrooper in the 11th Airborne Division for 2.5 years in the occupation of Japan, which was a very fine tour of duty.
We're talking this week with retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, and the co-author with Joe Galloway of the acclaimed book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, which in 2002 was made into a feature movie starring Mel Gibson. When we return, I ask him how accurate a portrayal he thought it to be. The conversation will continue after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiadin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network. Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, now online at radioamerica.org.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, who recorded his experiences in the Vietnam War in the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, which was made into a feature film starring Mel Gibson as Moore. Moore's path to Vietnam was charted in the early 1960s, when the Army decided to create a mobile airborne division for the first time. Moore wanted to be in on the creation.
I was a student at the Navy War College at Newport, Rhode Island. And I read in the Army Times about this new unit that was going to be formed at Fort Benning, Georgia, to test air mobility and air assault tactics. And the unit was to be commanded by Major General Harry Kennard. And when I volunteered for the airborne test section, my initial boss was Lieutenant Colonel Harry Kennard. And so I wrote him a letter. I was a lieutenant colonel, and he's a major general now. And I wrote him a letter asking for command of an infantry battalion. in this new air assault division, which was going to be at Fort Benning, Georgia, testing air mobile air assault tactics. A whole new category of tactics in the Army, in any Army.
It seems so obvious, and yet it is nonetheless the case that this is a totally new concept.
Well, you got to got to flip your mind back to 1964, when there were very few helicopters in the services. Mm-hmm. Now helicopters are everywhere, taking tourists here or there, everywhere. But back in 1964, there were very few civilian helicopters. And the Bell Helicopter Company developed the UH-1D, which we call the Huey. And I was particularly imaginative in my use of helicopters to get on the flanks of the unit portraying the enemy, or get into his rear. And that was the whole beauty of air assault, air mobile tactics, is to save the troops from getting wore out walking through forests and jungles, up hills and mountains, and fly them into an objective area where they'd be fresh, and resupply them with the helicopters as well, with water and ammunition and food. I was very imaginative in my employment of assault helicopters. In all of the maneuvers we had, we were on maneuvers in South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, for weeks, months at a time. And
well, General Kennard picked you to join his outfit.
Yeah.
And he pretty much give you your head in terms of helping develop the proper use of these new tactics?
Yes. General Kennard was an absolutely great commander. He allowed his subordinate commanders maximum flexibility in their own imagination. And I took him at his word. And I really became very, very fluid in my employment of helicopters. And I would, if I were given, say, 16 helicopters for a mission, if the mission called for a battalion assault, then I was in command of all the helicopters going into the objective area. But if I was given a mission to search and destroy a whole large area, I would break down these 16 helicopters to infantry platoon leader. I'd give a platoon leader four helicopters or two helicopters. Mm-hmm. I always have been a great proponent of power down. Push your decision-making authority down, and train your people to be able to make a good estimate of the situation and to come up with the best possible solution in a matter of seconds. And that was exactly General Kennard's philosophy as well.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. We'll return with our guest, retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations.
The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
Cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore. He was a lieutenant colonel and battalion commander in Vietnam's Central Highlands when the first major battle between U.S. forces and the North Vietnamese took place.
In my battle in the Idrung Valley, I did not have a colonel and a general hovering over me in a helicopter telling me what to do. I was in charge on the ground,
right,
which is the way it should be. Now, later on in that war, there'd be a company commander would be in a fight on the ground, and it'd be a battalion commander in his command helicopter circling. Above him, the brigade commander. Above him, the assistant division commander for operations. Above him, the division commander. And they're all up on top of this lieutenant on the ground who's trying to run a fight.
Right.
But that was later in the war. That didn't happen in the year that I fought in Vietnam.
No, but I've had specific reference to the fact that you could only go to a certain point. The enemy could go just a foot and a half beyond that and know that he had sanctuary.
Well, that's exactly right, and that bothered us a lot. In November, December of 65, when we defeated the North Vietnamese force, which was fresh in the country, this was the first time that they had had large regimental units in South Vietnam, fresh off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And my battle was 6 miles east of Cambodia, and we defeated the enemy after 3 days, and he fell back, leaving hundreds of his dead on the field. And he fell back with his survivors and wounded into Cambodia. And we wanted to pursue him to the death. I was taught at West Point, when you defeat an enemy on the battlefield, you pursue that enemy to the death. Finish the job. But General Westmoreland asked, he was told to stop at the border. But then he asked the president for permission to pursue the enemy into Cambodia. And the president denied him permission, which of course presented to Hanoi the gift of an inviolate sanctuary, which he used for the rest of that war. And we all know about the invasion of Cambodia later on, the brief invasion and the results of that, Cambodia and Laos, but by then it was far too late in coming. We're talking 1965, and I think the invasion of Cambodia was like 71.
71 or 2.
71
yeah.
or 2,
yeah.
But Had we been allowed to go into Cambodia, I think we could have done a lot of damage to that enemy and destroyed his line of communications to a great degree. But the president stated, we want no wider war. And that was the rule for 5 or 6 years.
So where'd you go after Vietnam?
Oh, after Vietnam, I was ordered to the Pentagon, where I worked in the office of the Secretary of Defense, Far East, and I was on the Vietnam desk. And primarily all I did was answer letters that Americans wrote to their congressmen and senators. They sent it over to the Pentagon and wrote me a reply. And I watched McNamara and McNaughton, the Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. I watched them go through torture for the year that I was there, trying to get a handle on that war in Vietnam, and they never could. Following that, I was sent to the Navy War College for a year and then to the 11th Airborne Division, which changed my life.
How?
After that.
Yeah. How did that change your life?
Oh. That. The place that I have always felt more comfortable is on a battlefield. And I think I was blessed with the ability to keep calm during a battle, and make decisions, set the example, and I was a good battlefield commander. And after that, I was sent. That's when I was sent to the Secretary of Defense's office after Vietnam. And I kept asking the assignment people in the Army. I was a colonel, and I kept asking to send me back to Vietnam. I know how to fight that enemy. I know that enemy. Know his habits, the techniques. But the answer was, you've had your turn. Which of course was a grave mistake on the part of the Army not to keep sending. They should have kept sending competent commanders back to Vietnam.
They should have taken advantage of the fact that you had had your turn.
Yeah, I knew the enemy. I knew the terrain. I knew the tactics. But that began the time of what's called ticket punching in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
When lieutenant colonels and colonels would get sent to Vietnam to command a battalion or a brigade, get their tickets punched. And it cost a lot of men killed to get those tickets punched. But after the Secretary of Defense office, I was selected for a fellowship to Harvard Center for International Affairs. So I was sent to Harvard for a year, where I studied under Kissinger and Reischauer. All those heavy hitters.
You described a minute ago a situation in which a lieutenant on the ground has got a captain above him whirling around, and a major whirling above him, and a lieutenant colonel, and a colonel, and on up. But it just occurred to me when you were discussing that to wonder, what has the cell phone done to all that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for God's sakes, a colonel can call the lieutenant on the ground just like that these days. Doesn't make any difference where he is. Is that a factor in terms of what I would call interference with the local command.
Oh, yeah. A cell phone has created a whole new type of addiction in America.
And the world.
You can walk in that lobby downstairs now, and you'll probably see two or three people with a telephone hanging out of their ear.
Yeah.
I think it has negatively affected the chain of command in business, and on the other hand, it has given senior business and military leaders immediate access to information on the ground.
Yeah.
Now, the smart commander has got to be very careful in how he handles this capability. He cannot become an office worker. He's still the boss. And he can't take away the initiative and the intelligence of subordinates. In my time in the Pentagon, when I was a planner in operations, military operations, and when I was personnel chief of the Army, that was my last duty in the Army. I was personnel, deputy chief of staff personnel. I had several hundred people working for me in the Pentagon for almost 3 years. And my first day of duty, I put out my policies, which was power down. And I put out the word to all my people, if you feel comfortable and qualified to make a decision, make it. If you don't feel comfortable and qualified, push it up a notch.
Hal Moore and his co-author, Joe Galloway, chronicled his Vietnam experiences in the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, which in 2002 was made into a feature movie starring Mel Gibson as the Lieutenant Colonel. I asked him how accurate a portrayal he thought it to be.
I think Mel did a great job, and we became good friends over the year or two, making it the movie. And we keep in touch. The movie was about 75% accurate as compared to the book. The part of the movie that my wife and I really objected to was the part where she was shown personally delivering telegrams of men who were killed in action to the families. Now, my wife didn't do that. When this battle hit, this was the first major battle of the Vietnam War involving Americans. And then the telegrams started coming, delivered by cab drivers. And my wife found out what was going on, and you know, she didn't know if the next telegram was going to come to her door. And in fact, a cab driver did come to her door and knocked on the door. And Julie said, well, I won't answer the door and he'll go away. But then she said, come on, face up. And he was hunting directions to another house to which he wanted to deliver this terrible telegram. So my wife found out about this awful, impersonal way of notifying a family that the husband or son had just been killed. And she raised hell with the Army. Now, here's a little old lady in Columbus, Georgia, and she's calling up the post commander at Fort Benning. She's calling up the Army and the Pentagon, and she raised hell. And she got that changed to where an officer and a chaplain would deliver those terrible news. Of course, when the knock on the door comes and the wife opens the door, or the mother opens the door and sees a chaplain and an officer in uniform, they know what's going to happen. But it's more humane than a taxi cab driver delivering a telegram. She didn't live on a post at Fort Benning, Georgia, as depicted in the movie. Sergeants did not live in those mansions, those nice big quarters. It took me 20 years to qualify to be assigned one of those sets of quarters. And in the movie, it shows sergeants living in those nice big houses. So that was all bull. And my wife, all the families who lived at Fort Benning, when the 11th Air Assault Division changed into the 1st Cav Division, Air Mobile, and was ordered to Vietnam, the families were given 30 days to move off the post. Get out. The Army didn't care where they went, just get off the post. So my wife, with 5 kids under 12 years old, she found a little house in Columbus, Georgia, right outside the gates.
Our thanks to retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore for sharing his experiences on Veterans Chronicles.
This is Tim Holbert from the American Veterans Center inviting you to join us for our upcoming 12th annual conference, November 12th through the 14th in Washington, D.C. The conference is your opportunity to meet some of America's greatest military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan, hearing their stories of valor firsthand. Confirmed participants include General David Petraeus, commander of CENTCOM, Air Force Colonel and retired astronaut Buzz Aldrin, several of the Band of Brothers from World War II, Baseball Hall of Famer and World War II vet Bob Feller, Dutch Van Kirk, navigator of the Enola Gay, recipients of the Medal of Honor, veterans portrayed in the film Black Hawk Down, decorated heroes from today's military, and much, much more. Conference attendees are also invited to exclusive receptions, including one honoring our wounded warriors currently recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. To request a full schedule or registration form, visit our website at www.AmericanVeteranCenter.org. Call 703-302-1012, extension 220, or email avc@AmericanVeteranCenter.org. That's avc@AmericanVeteranCenter.org. Spend Veterans Day weekend in the company of heroes.